Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we celebrate Robert Finch. For nearly two decades, Robert Finch shared his writings about the natural world and our place in it on a Cape Cod notebook. Earlier this month, Bob passed away at the age of 81. Joining us this morning is Bob's wife, Kathy Shore. Good morning, Kathy.
Hi, Mindy.
Also with us is his close friend, Dennis Minsky. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning.
Kathy, you know, many listeners of CIA were introduced to Bob with the Cape Cod Notebook, but this was not his first experience with radio.
No, as far as I know, his first experience came in 50 years ago in 1974 when he did a show called Cape Naturalist of the Air for WVLC, the Voice of the Lower Cape radio station at the time. He did them on reel-to-reel tape, and all I know is that after a number of weeks, John Hay, well-known Cape Cod writer, came to him and said, Bob, perhaps radio is not your métier. And from that point, Bob pivoted, and within a year, he was writing a column that appeared in four Cape newspapers, and kind of the rest is history. Yeah. But he did make the comeback 20 years ago.
He certainly got that after a while, right? Because his voice was just so great and really resonated with so many listeners. And Dennis, you're also a contributor to a Cape Cod Notebook, and I know that Bob was a great inspiration to you.
A great, great influence on me. I'm only realizing how much of an influence as I've been going back and reading his work since he passed away. I've been, I have the entire collection, and I've been reading from this and that. And so much resounds with me, and so many of my thoughts I see he had expressed, 50 years or 40 years ago. So, he was an inspiration for me. He was a model of how to be a writer, and he was a good friend. And I was only remembering that the first time I ever went clamming, my wife Deborah and I went clamming, I think was with Bob. You know, I was a Pennsylvania boy and came up here, and first time I ever dragged a rake through the sand, I think was with Bob Finch. So, yeah, he will remain a big part of my life.
Yeah. Kathy, I'm wondering, you know, I remember when Bob won the Murrow Award for his essay on the spider in the mailbox. And I was like, Bob, you're so observant. And he was like, no, I don't know that he understood how observant he really was. I'm like, I would never think of that. Was he in the backyard going, hey, Kathy, look at that, you know, whatever that little, I mean, was that him?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I do know that his writing, when it said the other day or last week, was culled from thoughts of 40, 50 years ago in his journals that he indexed completely, so that what you were seeing, I mean, it was in the journals. And the art was taking them, and sometimes things that showed up over a period of years, you know, looking at three or four journals decades apart. But I would say that he always had a kind of interesting, observant, and independent mind that would come out with things that were different from what you had thought of or what you expected.
Yeah. And I think there's, of course, a lot to Bob that listeners don't know. Right, like his addiction to Coca-Cola,
right?
And what else? What else?
His addiction to potato chips.
Potato chips and
the
Coca-Cola.
The fact that he was a daily subscriber for decades to the Boston Globe and read the front section over breakfast and had the comics with lunch. And if the paper was late, the day was off to a bad start, you know.
So I think a lot of folks know that Bob was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and we could hear the changes in his voice over time. And I want to bring Dan Tridle in for a second because, of course, Dan was Bob's producer. And Dan, I mean, there was times when Bob used to, way before COVID, would come to the station to record, and you started going out to his house to record with him. And I know you want to share some thoughts about that.
The last time I did record Bob was in July, this last July, and his voice was not doing well. And he was going to see a physical therapist for that. But he was intent on, he wanted to go to some of the cliffs, the dunes in Wellfleet. And I was concerned because he was having a difficult time walking inside the house. But I reminded him that a physical therapist had told him that if you march, you're doing fine. So we went outside and he took his walking stick and was just marching on. He was great. He knew where he wanted to go, and we wanted to go down this path. He wanted to go down this path, and I was having a great time. And then I said, Bob, there's no path here. He wanted to go down the dunes. And he said, no, we're going to go here. And he started, he went down the dunes and he started tumbling. It's like ass over tea kettle, just tumbling down. And I'm going, oh my God. And I'm running past him and I'm falling down. And we both landed at the bottom, and he sat up and he started laughing. He started laughing. He says, that's how we used to do it years ago. He was strong.
Yeah.
He was strong.
Yeah. Spirit. And I know, Dan, you've pulled some of Bob's essays for us to hear this morning. So tell us what we're going to hear first.
This is an essay that he did in December 2019. It's about Newcomb Hollow Beach. It's called Under the Clay Cliffs. Here we go.
On Monday afternoon, I went out to Newcomb Hollow, where an enormous amount of sand had been removed from the beach by the new moon tides and easterly winds of the past several days. The beach erosion revealed a horizontal floor of blue clay that ran along the base of the cliffs for at least 200 feet in a band 20 to 30 feet wide. These wide horizontal ledges were a mixture of solid blue and yellow-reddish clay feathered with thin exfoliations of rust-colored iron oxide. The impression was that of walking over a slick and fragile tessellated marble floor. I planned to go out the next morning to photograph these cliffs, but the next 4 days were full of wind and rain, with strong gusts from the northeast and east. I finally got out there yesterday afternoon, just a little past high tide. The cut in the beach had softened and sloped considerably with subsequent overwashes, but to the south was a scene more reminiscent of the Oregon coast than Cape Cod. Through a mist of shattering waves, a furious surf was flinging itself head-on, as if with self-destructive intent, full force against the lower third of the clay banks, bursting in tremendous crashes and flinging spray 12 to 15 feet into the air. There was no way to approach these cliffs by way of the beach. It would have been suicide to try it. Beyond this fury, several hundred yards to the south, the beach was exposed again, and lying upon it, like stranded sea beasts, were the wrecks of several trees. At this distance their size was impossible to gauge, but as with all objects on the beach, they looked quite large. The following morning the weather cleared, and I went out to Newcomb Hollow again, about an hour and a half before low tide. The wind, though still out of the northeast, had lessened, and with it the fury of yesterday's surf. But the bluffs were still agitated. Up above the clay deposits, a nearly continuous array of sandfalls, blown back by the dry onshore wind, created a veil of white mist smoke that swirled and rippled away south in the morning wind. A 10-foot-high scrub oak, on its way to becoming one of the stranded, blackened skeletons on the beach beyond it, stood halfway down the slope, its yellow-brown leaves fluttering as if celebrating its own death. At one point, as I stood looking up at the cliffs, a large section of blue clay slightly to my right detached itself from the bluff and fell over with an enormous thump at my feet. Further to the right and near the top of the cliff, a miniature avalanche of darker sand, at least 6 feet wide, streamed down the slope. It seemed that for once the bluffs of the outer beach were not content with merely mimicking the ocean in its frozen form, but were actively trying to rival the sea's motion in real time. It was like watching something frozen and rusted come alive, with stiff but powerful movements of its limbs and torso, destroying itself in the effort. The beach and the cliff were once more on the move in a symphony of form and motion.
So beautiful. He really gave us pause to really see the world around us. And after the news of Bob's passing came out, we got this email from Eleanor, who I think sums up the way a lot of listeners feel. So she wrote, "Without ego or grandstanding, Robert Finch was a relief to hear, read, and now remember. Never an alarmist or finger wag, he saw the solitary effects of the pandemic as a way to find a restorative prescription. There was nothing of his selected world, the Cape and Islands natural world, that didn't interest Finch. It's interests most all of us who choose to live here. But the dexterous way this writer had of putting those observations into words, that was a gift of pure inspiration. With the loss of Robert Finch, NPR/CAI loses a unique voice and a profound environmental advocate. We listeners lose a kindred soul. Thank you, CAI, for introducing us." Isn't that a lovely note? It's so sweet.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny, when I was listening to that essay, Dennis, I was thinking of you because I know you so appreciate and often comment on the way Bob describes our natural world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Would this be a time when I could share? I just found two sentences of his that just knocked me over.
Yeah, sure.
Can I share them?
Yes,
now?
Absolutely.
I'm reading from The Common Ground. It might be his first collection, Kathy, is that right? Yeah. And this is where he talks about loons. And he says, you know, Cape Cod's a great place, but our loons are nothing. Our winter loons are nothing compared to what they are up north.
Right.
And here he describes a lake up in, I guess, in New Hampshire. All through the evenings and nights we spent there, we could hear the loons calling to one another across the dark lake. Wild, wondrous canticles plucked from the lake's bottom on their long, deep dives, balanced a moment in their throats, then flung up toward the stars, the moon-edged clouds, and the dark, brooding shapes of the mountains sliding away, one behind the other, into the steep night. What a noise there must have been when owls sang in the tall virgin pines, when lynx screeched out their passion, and wolves added their howls to the loon's weird wailings. And I just thought, wow.
Wow, yeah. Yeah.
That's some writing there.
That's for sure. Let's talk to Greg O'Brien, who's calling in. I know Greg also found a lot of inspiration from Bob. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I, because of my progressing dementia, I had to write this down, so I can't, you know, talk off clip. But I knew Bob Finch since my late 20s when I was editor of the Cape Codder, and Bob was writing bucolic nature columns for the paper. And we continued the friendship for many decades. Bob was, still is, an inspiration to me. I wrote about Bob, a literary hero to me, often from Boston Magazine to Boston Herald to the Naturalist of the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History, which we both edited at different times. I was blessed, so blessed, to have Bob as a writing mentor. He made me better. He taught me that words have sounds, not just letters, and a good writer thus is a conductor in a word symphony. I was in the horn section. Bob was the conductor. Mm-hmm. Bob taught me to write from my heart, as poets do, not from the head. Bob taught me how to get into the zone when you write. Bob knew the zone well. You know, Mindy, it's ironic that we both have dealt at different times with different forms of dementia. I love Bob, and I always will.
Mm-hmm. Greg, thank you for calling in and sharing that with us. We appreciate that. And we would love to hear from others who have thoughts they'd like to share about Bob. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Kathy, go ahead. You want to say something?
Yeah. I just want to pick up on something that Greg said about the fact that words had sounds, and Bob was very much a student of music. You know, he played, he was offered a full scholarship in college to be a music major. He chose a different path, but music was always very close to him. He was a pianist. He sang in chorales for over 40
Right.
years, and music really shaped his language. It shaped the way that he approached the world. He was a huge fan of Henry Beston because of Beston's kind of musical
Yeah.
writing.
I had forgot about the singing in the chorale. He really enjoyed that. That I forgot. Thanks for reminding us of that. We are celebrating the life of Robert Finch, and we will have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are celebrating Robert Finch for nearly two decades. He shared his writings about the natural world and our place in it on a Cape Cod notebook. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us is Bob's wife, Kathy Shore, and close friend, Dennis Minsky. Now joining us on the phone is Sohail Zende, Bob's college roommate. Hi, Sohail.
Hi. Good morning. I actually was not his roommate, but I was his. We lived in the same dorm.
In the same
and
dorm.
I got to know reasonably well first freshman year. And then we got, as time went on, we got to know each other better. His reputation from one of his actual roommates was Bob doesn't speak very much, but when he speaks, it's important. And it was like, oh, okay. I kind of, all right, I get it. And then later on, I got to know him. It's like, he talked all the time. He said everything. He's like, he had opinions about everything. So I don't know. Anyway, it was fun to get to know him all those years ago. And we've been close, on and off for 60 years.
Yeah, it's a long time.
1961, when we first met.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite memory, Sohail, that you would like to share?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, he was into many different things, including baseball. And Joe Castiglione, who retired as the announcer of the base of the Red Sox this year, was one of his favorites. And he talked about Joe all the time. He talked about baseball. He did theater. We did the theater together. We did carpentry together. And, of course, he played music. And the music part is what I want to get to.
Mm-hmm.
He was not a nationalist or ethnic in particular, but he was quite proud of his Hungarian ancestry. One of his grandfathers was Hungarian. And he brought that up from time to time. He cooked with Hungarian spices, paprika. And it was just one of his peculiarities, one of the things that he did that he enjoyed doing. When I heard recently that when he was in Hungary with Kathy on a trip, they went looking for Bartok's home. Bela Bartok was a Hungarian composer of the 20th century who one of the greatest composers of the 20th century, actually. Mm-hmm. And Bob and I talked about Bela Bartok's music from time to time, including a piece that we both thought was very important called Concerto for Orchestra. As it happened, Concerto for Orchestra was on the program of the Boston Philharmonic just last Sunday. I went with my wife to hear it and in Symphony Hall. And before the concert, as is his normal pattern, Ben Zander, conductor of the Philharmonic, spoke about Bartok and the composition of the concerto. And I didn't know this very well. I knew that Bartok was very ill toward the end, but I didn't know exactly how it went down. Bartok was in the hospital. He was suffering from leukemia. He was he had left Germany. He was not a Jew, but he had left Germany during the Nazi years. He had left Hungary during the Nazi years after Germany invaded Hungary. And he was in America, but relatively unknown, even though in Europe he was a very well-known composer. And because of his illness, he ended up in the hospital in 1941, and the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic, Serge Koussevitzky, went to see him. He was known among the musicians, even though he wasn't known among the public. Mm. And Koussevitzky said to him, I'm going to give you money to compose a piece for Boston Symphony. And Bartok was very ill. He was down to 87 pounds.
Oh,
he was basically, he thought he was a goner.
Mm.
And Koussevitzky said, no, you're going to compose this piece for us. And I'm going to give you an advance of $500. And there'll be $500 more when you finish.
And he did it.
And Bartok came out of that. And eventually, it took him a couple of years. But he finished this incredible piece, which we then got to hear. And what I heard in the concert hall, which I had never heard before, partly because Zander is that kind of composer, conductor. He brings out the feelings of the music very well. And I felt the anguish in this music and the triumph at the end. And this was the thing that, to me, this was a message. My wife said to me also, this was a message from Bob. Mm. Bob had gone through this tremendously debilitating illness in his last number of years. And at the very end, he decided he was going to do a book.
Mm-hmm.
And he produced, over the last year, he actually produced this book, which will be published in the spring. And he did it. And
he
there was
it.
This tremendous courage that came out of that being down and ill and unable to see the future and yet working toward the future the way Bartok did and the way Bob did.
Right. So that is a lovely. So I want to bring Kathy in here because Kathy, we talked about this. He finished the book.
Right.
He got
a contract in June of 2022. He had 2 years to write this book, and he basically put off and put away everything else, and he worked longer hours than I've ever seen him work in 30 years. You know, he just would be working from the morning into the evening. And in fact, the last thing, I think maybe the last day he was conscious, I showed him 4 book jackets and we picked out what would be the book jacket for the new book that's coming out with W.W. Norton next June.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that. So thank you for sharing. I know we've got a lot of folks here wanting to chime in. Thank you for being part of this morning. We appreciate you calling in. Next, I want to go to John Elder, who's a co-editor and fellow writer with Bob, the editor of the Norton Book of Nature. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, thank you so much for doing this celebration of Bob. And I thought maybe I could just talk a little bit about my friendship with Bob, which was framed by literature, and the way in which his personality and his writing seemed to me similar.
Mm-hmm.
How's that sound?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. And it really builds on some of the things that have already been said about Bob. We were friends for about 40 years. We met at the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and then Bob invited me to be his co-editor for the Norton Book of Nature Writing, which meant we spent hundreds of hours together talking about our favorite books and why we liked them. And then we also had a lot of contacts through the Orion Society. We both wrote for Orion Magazine, and we both went to wonderful retreats at Camp Glenbrook in New Hampshire, hosted by our friend Parker Huber. And so one of the things I wanted to say about Bob is that I got to know him through his love of literature. And since we were always editing and then revising the Norton book, we had a lot of conversations about literature. And already there's been an emphasis in his radio talks about his wonderful description.
Mm.
I think really that's one of the things that made him love literature. The last conversation I had with Bob and Kathy were at the University of Vermont Medical Center toward the end of his life. We got to talking about description, and he brought up on the phone and read to us Steinbeck's description in Grapes of Wrath of a tortoise making its way with some interruptions across a desert highway. And it's a it's just a sort of a set piece. It's a long description of a tortoise walking across the road, and it's just the kind of thing that Bob loved. And hearing those great extracts that have already been read, what strikes me is that the descriptions are fuller and more extended than they would be in many writers. And in fact, for me, that kind of description was Bob's persona. You know, we talk about the voice of a writer. His was the voice of a noticer who loved the details of the world. That's who he was as a person, and it's who he was as a writer.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I wanted to mention that strikes me as I take this occasion to think about Bob. The other thing about Bob, again, it's been mentioned before, and I think very appropriately, Bob had a wonderful, wonderful sense of humor. This just came out in the last anecdotes from Bob's roommate. He's always had a wonderful sense of humor. But when I think of his humor, excuse me, I don't think primarily of Bob as a joke teller. I think of him as a guy who, in recalling some delightful, odd detail in daily life, just his face just was illuminated. He loved the oddness of the world and the particularity of moments in the world. So that, just as I would say, for me, Bob's extraordinary descriptions were his persona. Mm. They gave the picture of a noticer. His humor for me was associated with, I guess the words I would use are kindly amusement. he loved the oddness of the world. It was a great pleasure. And then the last thing I want to share from friendship and also from our discussions of literature, Dan mentioned marching on with Bob, tumbling off the dunes. And Bob had an intrepid quality, kind of a Huck Finn quality, a mischievous, or maybe more like the expoticians, you know, in Winnie the Pooh. He loved setting out on little undertakings and making big adventures of them. Just a walk in the woods. And a number we've had a little exchange online after Bob's passing among those of us who spent time at the Glenbrook camp with him. And a number of us remember how when we would go for our walks up there in the New Hampshire hills, often we'd have mosquitoes or no-see-ums around us. And that's where Bob showed us how to make punks. This is a word from his New Jersey early days. You cut a dry cattail, and you light the end of it so that it begins to smoke. You clamp the dry stem between your teeth in a kind of rakish Churchillian angle, and you walk on with a little wreath of acrid smoke around your head that keeps all the bugs away. And I can still remember several of us walking along in our little individual smoke wreaths, and Bob's great pleasure in the oddity of it all.
Yeah. I love that description of the mischievous Huck Finn that's also a noticer, right? I mean, that really that just says a lot about
exactly.
It.
Yeah. You know, he was the and they relate, you know, again, when I think of Bob as a person and as a writer, the attributes that are most characteristic for me is he had a sense of solemn mischief. Mm-hmm. Now, here we go now, marching along. And he had a sense of serious play. We're playful, but we're getting at something important. So anyway, that's what I loved about Bob and what I think so many of us also love about Bob's writing.
Right. John, thank you for sharing that. Boy, you said a lot about Bob right there that I could see both Dennis and Kathy shaking their heads. Thank you, John, for sharing that. I want to move on to Brian Morris, who early on in Bob's radio career with us did a lot of editing with Bob. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good. So you want to share some thoughts about Bob with us?
Sure. Well, as you know, I had my own studio out in Eastham before I came to work full-time at CAI. And I think Bob first came to me in, I think it was 2006, might have been 2005. And he came to me to begin recording some of his essays in audio form. And I think, you know, that was really the beginning of a Cape Cod notebook. And we worked together for, I think it must have been 10 years or more, with him mostly coming to my studio at first, and then later I would, just as Dan was describing earlier, I would then go to his house in Wellfleet to record him there. And I had been a big fan of Bob's writing before I moved to the Cape in 1991, so it was really great to eventually get to meet him and get to work with him on these audio essays. And, you know, Bob always said that I made him sound good, but to tell you the truth, recording and editing Bob Finch was never a heavy lift. He was always completely prepared. And again, I think Dan Trotter would probably back me up on this. At most, I'd have to redo a line here or a phrase there, and that was about it. And then it would just, he sounded so great just going in.
Yeah.
And, you know, from time to time, he'd be able to get through an entire essay with no flubs whatsoever, and that would just be...
One take, yeah. That's hard to do.
One take, yeah. And he was just had this amazing gift with his words and insights. And just as everyone has been saying today, also, he had this terrific, wonderful sense of humor. He was a great guy and always a good friend to me. And I'm really grateful to have had the chance to know him and to work with him and to sort of, you know, watch the the sausage being made, as they say.
Yeah.
To have that behind the scenes look at the process and be part of it.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, everyone's been talking about his incredible powers of observation. And I remember one time it's been a long time, so I can't remember what, I think it was for a slideshow or something, but he and I went down to, I think it was North Light in East Ham, just to do a sort of a walk and talk interview where he would just observe things about the beach. And, you know, he would just walk around and point out things that most of us would just blow right by and never even notice. I remember him specifically, and this was in the essay that you guys aired a few minutes ago, about the sand as it was coming down the cliffs that was happening, and he would point that out and explain to me what it meant geologically and all this stuff. Or I think he noticed an old pipe sticking out of the dunes, and he kind of knew what it would have been eventually, what it would have been used for, or
where it
might have been connected to back before the dunes eroded, you know. And it was just crazy. He would notice these things that most people just wouldn't think to see.
So true. Incredible. So true. Yeah. Brian, thanks for sharing your thoughts and calling in this morning. We appreciate that. Kathy, did Bob practice these before he would, you know, record with Brian and Dan? Was he practicing these? Because, you know, people don't really, if they don't work in radio, they don't know. One take is not that easy to do.
Well, he practiced everything. He practiced before he gave a reading. He marked up scripts. But he also practiced in between chorale practices, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I think when you're a student in that way, you learn how to practice and repeat and go over the places where you're stuck.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to say about, and people's commenting about how observant or how wise or, you know, how beautifully those things came out in his writing is that he didn't talk that way. I mean, he had a very interesting mind, but a lot of what he discovered came from the experience of writing,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, until I know what I write to find out what I think and what I saw.
Yeah.
I think it's an important distinction.
Yeah, absolutely. We are celebrating Robert Finch this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are celebrating Robert Finch this morning with his wife, Kathy Shore, and friend Dennis Minsky, who is also an essayist for a Cape Cod Notebook. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Jim is calling from Wellfleet. Good morning, Jim.
Howdy. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Go ahead. Hi, Kathy. Hi, Dennis. this is Jim Gilbert, guys, okay, just so you know which Jim it is. I wanted to sort of throw in, because so many of the comments this morning are about people in the business, just you know, how important he was to people like me who you know, had a career in journalism. And I first ran into Bob in the mid-70s. Working as my first job in journalism, which was for the Provincetown Advocate, which published, I had to ask Kathy because I couldn't remember his you know, famous to me and to many people who read it in the day, Soundings. That's right, isn't it, Kathy? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And anyway, yeah, okay. And so I was very proud of myself. It was a part-time job, and I worked there for 6 months. And then Duane Steele bought the magazine, and I was worried for my job horribly because I, you know, was starting to have a little family and not making a whole lot of money and just didn't want to leave Cape Cod. And I was greatly relieved when Duane Steele, you know, said, "Jim, I'm going to give you a raise. I'm going to make you a member of the staff, not a, you know, part-timer anymore." And I was just overjoyed that for the $11,000 a year that he offered me. But it was my first full-time job in journalism. And the very first assignment that I got from Duane Steele was to edit Bob's column. And so I spent many parts of my first, you know, weeks and months and years in journalism, you know, looking forward every week to his column, which, by the way, didn't require pretty much any editing, mm-hmm. but it was, you know, gave me a chance to have a cup of coffee and enjoy. Over the years, I finally realized why Duane gave me his column to edit, which really didn't need any editing. Duane was a big fan of his, and I think Duane, he's just, you know, passed away recently, and so I can't really ask him, but he just saw some potential in me, and he thought that Bob would be who I should be reading on a regular basis to improve my writing.
Yeah, good influence, so right? Yeah.
Very good influence, and you know, you can ask me any other questions, but that's you know, it's just such a fond, you know, part of my life to have had that experience with Bob and to have known him for all these years.
Yeah, so I mean, we're hearing this morning. We knew this already, Kathy, but so many people, Bob, you know, inspired along the way, right? Mm-hmm. So many. Mm-hmm. We probably could talk all day with the people that he's inspired. Jim, thank you for sharing that with us. Sure. We also have Lori calling from Provincetown. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Kathy. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
I guess that I want to first just say the things that delighted me about his writing. I think that Bob was able to find everything, all of the minutiae in the world, fascinating. Mm-hmm. And he wrote, the phrasing that he had was absolutely gorgeous. And he brought you on his journey with him. I felt like I was walking with him. I was, you know, experiencing what he was experiencing. And that delighted me personally. I think I have been lucky enough to have a rental of a dune shack for the last 30 plus years in the dunes off of Provincetown. And Kathy, one of the stories that I think about often is that Kathy and Bob were having dinner with my husband and myself. And after dinner, it was still light outside. They were going to walk home through the dunes. And a few minutes later, they came running back and they said, "You have to come out here. You have to come out here and see this." And the sky was bright red with northern lights, but bright red northern lights in the daytime. It was daylight. It was stunning. It was a stunning moment. And I often think about that because it was such a rare experience. And I think, you know, he wrote quite some absolutely magnificent stories about being in the dunes. He really understood the dunes and the park and, of course, all of Cape Cod in a way that most people just don't get.
Yeah, most people don't notice. Yeah, Lori, thank you for sharing your thoughts. And I think we're going to hear another one of Bob's essays. I love how Lori talks about she feels like she's taking the journey with him, because I think a lot of listeners feel that same way, and especially listeners who are only here part of the time or who love Cape Cod and live elsewhere. I think being able to, you know, go online or, you know, stream and hear about their favorite places is just kind of magical. So, Dan, what are we going to hear next?
I'd like to play you an essay that Bob did in October of 2012. He called this A Choir of Coyotes.
Last evening, as we waited for guests to arrive, we heard the choir of coyotes erupt in the marsh below. Their howling begins like geysers, abrupt and for no apparent reason, all at once and in full voice. It can go on for several minutes and then stop just as abruptly and mysteriously. It's like some sudden, full-blown hysteria, the way kids will suddenly be set off into fits of wild, hysterical screaming and giggles by something undetectable to adults, something even they were not aware possessed them until it did. The song of the coyotes came out at dusk, when Clemmy and her friends were still playing outside across the street. The children's screams and laughter blended and braided with the yelps and full-throated bayings of the coyotes, as if they sensed some half-conscious connection between them. The sounds of pre-adolescence and suburban yards mixing with those of recently arrived wild animals, animals who ask no leave to share our neighborhoods, apply for no occupancy permits, sign no covenants, meet no codes, pay no taxes. As I've said before, the wild doesn't care whether we believe in it or not, it just keeps on being wild. And now, nearly 400 years after the Pilgrims landed on our shores, we have once again become William Bradford's howling wilderness. Of such things are Puritanism and witch hunts born. I remember a decade or so ago when a citizens' group was formed in the Mid-Cape area calling for control of coyotes. "We don't want to eliminate them completely," said one citizen, "but why do you have to go out like Rambo to walk your dog?" "Our cats were part of our family," pleaded another who had lost them to coyotes. Naturalists reply that cats and other pets let outside without restraint become part of the food chain. Those questioning the coyotes' increasing presence assert that, unless they are taught a lesson, they will become more emboldened and perhaps threaten children. Those who defend the rights of coyotes to be here assert with equal conviction that these wild predators avoid humans and that limited food supplies will naturally control their population over time. It's survival of the fittest versus the balance of nature all over again. Warring metaphors. All wilderness is relative and is often equated with rarity. Once I read of Montana writer Rick Bass exulting in his ultimate wild sighting of a caribou on his home turf. Caribou. I had to laugh. This is the same animal that is so numerous in Newfoundland that lighthouse keepers have to sweep them away from their doorsteps. It was the same laughter I heard from friends in Vermont when I told them of the fuss we made over our Cape Cod bear earlier this year. For me, the wild is what engenders in us a sense of threat. Threat to safety, to the known, to stability, to our possessions, to our sense of entitlement to the land. In that sense, the Cape has been made more wild by coyotes, as our ocean beaches have recently been made more wild by great white sharks. They've made us more cautious, made us feel less safe, challenge our right of possession, pop up out of nowhere, gobble up our pets, howl their bacchanalian revelry, and then sink back down out of sight again into the moist thickets of swamp and marsh where we cannot follow them. And we call our children in from the night.
He gives us so much to think about, huh? I mean, wow. All right, let's talk to Margaret, who's giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Margaret.
Hi, this is Maggie Bossy calling from the director of the Chatham Corral. Yeah. So I just wanted to say that way back when, in the 90s, when I had only been doing the chorale for a few years, we decided to honor my predecessor, Marjorie Bennett Morley, and we commissioned a piece by another local composer who has also died in the last year, Ronald Pereira. And it was Bob who had the brilliant idea of setting portions of The Outermost House to music. And I would say that suggestion and the execution of that piece stays in my heart and spirit as the sort of best thing I was ever to accomplish. And it was really him who gave the spark.
Mm. Yeah. Margaret, yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
Maggie, I was just talking about you recently and talking about Bob's work and being in chorales and why he loved it so much. And a big part of it was, as someone who was self-guided, self-driven, worked alone, he not only loved being part of a bigger thing, but he, you know, absolutely adored being conducted by you and told what to do and said, here's the deal. You need to do it this way. You know, he loved being directed in that fashion.
Yeah.
Oh, what a great thing to hear. Well, and we had a lot of fun with him in different ways. He was a post-rehearsal drinking companion. And he, at our annual banquets, you could count on Bob to play and sing some old Tom Lehrer song that would just make everybody laugh. He was really something so special.
Yeah. Maggie, thank you thanks so much for calling and sharing your thoughts. I want to read another email that we got from Lisa at Lake Dunmore. She said, love from Lake Dunmore. Thank you for the poignant tribute to Bob Finch. We are listening up in Vermont, and his lake community celebrates the gifts of his friendship, his writing, and his kind heart. Lisa, thank you for chiming in. We got about a minute left, but I just want to say, folks, who go, oh, no, Bob Finch, we're never going to hear his essays again. No, we're still going to, from time to time, pull his essays, because we can't just sit on these and not share them with the world. So stay tuned. We have various essayists. Dennis will still continue. We've got other essayists who are doing Cape Cod Notebook, and we will still continue from time to time, especially seasonally, to share Bob's thoughts with the world. A quick final thought real quickly, Kathy. Anything? Dennis, either one of you, want to say anything else before we sign off?
I would leave it to Kathy, but I just think everything everyone said is so that he was a noticer, that he looked at that the details that most of us walk by, he could develop into something. Mm-hmm. And something Kathy said is that writers don't write down their thoughts. Writers think their thoughts in their writing. And it's a really important distinction. And Bob,
right,
is the
master.
That.
Yeah. And we'll, and you can get into our website, capeandislands.org, and see some of Bob's writings. And again, you can hear them, and we'll continue to honor his writing as we go forward. Kathy Shore, Dennis Minsky, thank you. And thanks to all who chimed in this morning to help us pay respects to Bob Finch. We appreciate that. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having us and for doing this.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.